From coast to coast and worldwide on the internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
And our very special guest tonight, Alexandra Robbins. She was on with me January 22nd, a year ago. She'll be back in a moment as we talk about Skull and Bones and some other things right here on Coast to Coast AM. New York Times best-selling author Alexandra Robbins is the author of Secrets of the Tomb, Skull and Bones, The Ivy League and the Hidden Paths of Power, also a book called Pledged, The Secret Life of Sororities, and Conquering Your Quarter-Life Crisis. We'll talk a little bit more about some of her work in just a moment. Alexandra, fitting to have you back right about now. How are you?
I'm doing fine. How are you doing, George?
I'm doing great. Great indeed. You know, since we last talked, that was in January of 2003.
Yes.
Boy, you've been all over the place talking about the secrets of the tomb. Are people now beginning to become aware of what this very secret organization is?
I think people are finally becoming aware that it's something that they should accept exists in this country. I think they're a little bit surprised that it did turn out to be a bones versus bones election after all. And these days, you know, we don't generally let any part of a presidential candidate's background go unchecked. We want to know everything. So I guess it's still a surprise that even though it's become a source of public interest, reporters still aren't pushing these candidates on their Skull and Bones experience.
I had Ralph Nader on a couple weeks ago, and you know, one of the things that he thinks both of these other candidates should do is really disclose and talk about Skull and Bones much more than they have, because they basically refuse to answer questions. They laugh about it when anybody asks them about it.
They do. They laugh about it, and they say, they basically dismiss questions about it by saying, oh, it's a secret, ha-ha, or, you know, it's I can't tell you because it's a secret. That's ridiculous. If we wouldn't accept that about any other part of their lives, but we accept that because of a secret society, I don't know why people are letting them get away with that.
Let's go back a little bit. When you started to investigate this Secrets of the Tomb, the Skull and Bones, how did this happen?
Why I began to investigate it?
Yeah.
Well, I like the idea of digging into secret group behavior, but I also realized that this is a subject that nobody had attacked as a valid subject of investigative journalism. There had been a lot of speculation on the topic, and this is a society that kept its secrets pretty safe for about 170 years, but no one had ever treated it as a serious work of investigative mainstream journalism. So I figured I'd give it a shot.
And this, of course, you know, is part of Yale University, this fraternity. You went to Yale as well, though, right?
I did, yes.
Okay. So I would explain what the building looks like that they hold their meetings in, and what is it called?
The building is called the Tomb. It's their headquarters. It's a crypt-like building. It's sort of a Egyptian, I don't even know how to describe it, sort of a Gothic structure. Made of brown sandstone. People like to say there are no windows. It's not quite true. There are a few windows where bonesmen can look out of, but you can't look in. It's smack in the middle of the Yale campus. It has a couple towers and an underground tunnel. It's just sort of a weird, sort of scary-looking building. I remember when I was a freshman, I would always walk a little faster when I had to walk past the Skull and Bones building at night.
Did you ever notice people trying to get in there? And I'm talking about non-bonesmen. Students would go up there and just try to walk in?
No, sometimes you'll see tourists pose for pictures outside, but people generally didn't try to mess with the Skull and Bones tomb.
How did the members get in? Do they all have keys?
No, there's a combination lock on the front door. In fact, if you try to pull one of the padlocks instead of doing the keypad combination, the doorbell rings, so they know that somebody's trying to get in.
Uh-huh. Okay, now, this organization is roughly, Alexandra, how old?
Skull and Bones began in 1832, so 170-some-odd years.
And a lot of prominent people have been in this organization.
Oh, sure. You have The Bushes, you have Kerry, you have people like William Buckley, Pulitzer Prize winner David McCullough, the founders of Time Incorporated, the founder of Federal Express. You know, I could go on. William Howard Taft, Walter Camp, the father of American football, Winston Lord, the former president of the Council on Foreign Relations. I mean, it's a long list of prestigious members. And what makes it so staggering is that we're not talking about a society like, for instance, the Freemasons with more than a million members. Skull and Bones has perhaps 800 living members at any one time. So for so many of them to reach positions of prominence is pretty astounding.
Now, the fact that so many of these people really make a mark on society in terms of the position they take, both in corporations and in government. Does that make the organization, does that make them bad or suspect?
No, I would say no, because it's sort of a chicken and egg question. On one hand, Skull and Bones only accepts people that they believe will reflect success and honor back on the society. On the other hand, and this is where the sort of suspect area hinges, is that Skull and Bones is probably the country's proportionally most powerful alumni network. So there are strings being pulled in many of these cases. That's what's suspect.
All right. When you started to investigate Skull and Bones, what did you find out? What is it? What do they do?
Well, I guess in a nutshell, Skull and Bones is America's most infamous secret society, and one that appears to wield real power even in 21st century America. It's based at Yale. It has that tomb. Its retreat is a private island that the society has owned since the early 1900s. And this is a society that has included among its members presidents, Supreme Court chief justices, CIA officials, cabinet members, congressmen, senators, and leaders of various industries.
Why are they so darn secretive, Alexandra?
That's a great question. I think one of the reasons they're secretive is because they do some things in the tomb that they shouldn't be proud of. Another reason they're probably secretive is because many of them enjoy the way that the secrecy surrounding the organization leads outsiders to project imagery of them that pretty much augments their power. People like to credit Skull and Bones for a lot of things that Skull and Bones shouldn't be given credit for.
I had heard, this is what I've heard, that they might have the skull of Geronimo there, that they stole it from somewhere.
Yeah. Of all the rumored items that are supposedly in the tomb, I think the Geronimo skull is a pretty plausible one, actually. According to the text of what seems to me to be an authentic Skull and Bones document, it talks about how George W. Bush's grandfather, Prescott, and some fellow bonesmen robbed the grave of the Apache chief and deposited the remains in Skull and Bones. They wrote in the document, basically they wrote about this experience, sort of bragging about it for the society, and I can read a little bit about it if you want.
Yeah, just a bit. Go ahead.
Sure. Well, this happened in 1918 when Prescott Bush and a few other members of Skull and Bones were stationed at the Army base at Fort Sill. The document talks about how they brought to the T its most spectacular crook. In Bones language, T means tomb and crook means theft. And then they went on to say, the skull of Geronimo the Terrible, the Indian chief who had taken 49 white scalps. They say an expedition planned with great caution since six army captains robbing a grave wouldn't look good in the papers. Then they go on to describe how they pried open the door of the tomb with an axe. They dug. Bush was the first one to start digging. The other alumni or patriarchs found a bridle, a saddle horn, and rotten leathers. They cleaned the skull with carbolic acid. They say the skull was very clean, having only some flesh inside and a little hair. And what's interesting is that the document describes, it names three people. There are six bonesmen there, but it names three of them: Prescott Bush, Ellery James, and Neil Mallon. Well, these people later became Prescott Bush, the future senator and grandfather of and father of the president's. Bush family friend Neil Mallon was a CEO of Dresser Industries, and Ellery James became a Brown Brothers Harriman partner. So these are pretty high-profile men
yeah.
who allegedly robbed this grave.
Pretty darn prominent. Now, have you ever been inside the tomb?
No, I would not go in the tomb. I think there are probably several ways I could have, but knowing Skull and Bones, I didn't want to give them any fodder in case they wanted to come after me later.
Now, were you told what it looked like on the inside?
Yes, by dozens of people.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about that, and then your methodology for how you were able to talk to, because you did talk to a lot of Skull and Bones members. What did they tell you, though, Alex, about how, and I can call you that for short, because that's what you call yourself sometimes,
oh, sure.
Right? Okay, what did they, how did they describe the inside of this place?
Oh, it's full of skulls and skeletons, both human and animal. There's a death motif, there's a war motif. There are relics from various wars. For example, Civil War muskets were sent back to the tomb by General Russell, that's the founder of Skull and Bones, to be used in initiation rites. There are relics from World War I, World War II. There are phrases engraved in German and Latin reminding the Bonesmen that they only have a short time on this earth. There's a lot of artwork celebrating death. The most grand room in the tomb is the dining room, or boodle, as they call it. And that's sort of a very large room with huge windows that looks onto a courtyard that's kind of like a secret garden for them.
Did anybody ever tell you whether somebody might have been hurt there or during any of their initiations?
People have been, I know there have been minor injuries in Skull and Bones. I know during the initiation, the initiate is sort of thrust about the tomb, and they tell him not to wear anything, they tell the initiates not to wear anything that has any metal or glass on them, because in the past, it's said that initiates were accidentally thrust into inanimate objects.
Oh my. How do the members get found? Who picks them?
Well, Skull and Bones consists of 15 Yale juniors. They're tapped the April of their junior year. They come back after summer break, and they're there in the tomb every Thursday and Sunday night for their senior year. Second semester, between January and April, they pretty much focus on elections. They sift through the entire junior class looking for the people who are going to reflect honor and success back onto the society, or failing that, who are very strong legacies. They spend a long time culling through the members of the junior class.
I was going to say, legacy is important to them, isn't it?
Legacy is important. It's not as important as it was in the mid-20th century. It's become a little less important. Now it's not enough if you had a father in Skull and Bones. You need a father, a grandfather, an uncle maybe to get in.
Now, how did you go about finding Skull and Bones members to talk to?
Well, I got a copy of the membership catalog, which isn't available publicly.
How'd you get that?
Well, I wish I could tell you. but anyway, so I was able to just start locating Bonesmen and talking to them. I'd say I probably interviewed, about 150, 175, though maybe twice that number, hung up on me or harassed me or threatened me or yelled at me and what an awful thing I was doing by writing about Skull and Bones. It was rather silly the way they treated it in some cases.
Tell me some of the really most horrendous episodes when you would call someone and they'd either hang up on you or threaten you.
Oh, well, one Bonesman joked that if the society wasn't portrayed in a positive light, he would send a few of his friends after me. I think the one that appalled me the most was not somebody I called. He called me, which was a little disconcerting. My book started with an article that I wrote for the Atlantic Monthly. After that article was published, this is a few years ago, I got a call at my office from another journalist whom I knew by name, mm-hmm. to be a member of Skull and Bones. And he started off by scolding me for writing the article. He said writing that article was not an ethical or honorable way to make a decent living in journalism. And then he asked me how much the Atlantic had paid me for the story. I don't tell people those things, so I didn't answer, and he hung up. 15 minutes later, he actually called me back, and he starts off immediately by saying, "I have just gotten off the phone with our people." And I started laughing, because this is a grown man.
Yeah, saying that. Our people.
Yeah, our people. And he said that the society demanded to know where I got my information. Of course, I wasn't going to go into that. He tried to butter me up and tried to get me to tell him the names of the Bonesmen whom I had interviewed. Obviously, I wasn't going to tell him that.
Mm-hmm.
And he got angry. He screamed at me. He berated me about how, in his words, I was dishonorable for even daring to write about the secret society. And I listened only out of curiosity, because I was curious where the conversation was going. Then he ended it by saying, "There are a lot of us at newspapers and at political journalism institutions across the country." And he goes, "Good luck with your career," and he slammed down the phone. Well, I was 23 when that happened.
Let me tell you, your career's been doing pretty well.
You know, I'm doing okay, although I have heard that this guy is still actively trying to destroy my career as
really?
A journalist. And I have to tell you, he'd be horrified to learn this, but it was that conversation that made me realize, you know what, I'm going to write a book now.
Had he kept quiet, you might not have done that then.
Who knows?
Well, you probably started to realize, you know, why do these people get so upset about a fraternity, right?
Well, Skull and Bones is more than a fraternity. I should
exactly.
make clear. Because
oh, I agree with that.
Because my latest book was about Greek life. I think that I know enough that there's a distinction between Greek life and secret societies. Skull and Bones, for example, does absolutely no community service. Doesn't even pretend to do any community
mm-hmm.
service. Whereas that is generally a part of Greek life.
Well, that's true. And if you had to define, Alexandra, what its mission is, Skull and Bones' mission, what might that be?
That's pretty simple. Skull and Bones' only agenda is to get its members into positions of power and then to have those members hire other members. Skull and Bones is basically one big institutionalized superiority complex. They want to elevate themselves above the rest of us, whom they call barbarians. That's Bones lingo for a non-Bones member.
Okay, so here we have George Bush, our president, Skull and Bones member, his top candidate, John Kerry, Skull and Bones member. Yet in a campaign, they sound like they hate each other. They sound like they attack each other's views and positions. Yet they are Skull and Bones members. So deep down inside, there's got to be this special bond between them, right?
Well, you know, I haven't talked to them directly about this, but I have talked to their sort of close circles of Bones friends. And what they say is that both men acknowledge that this is a special experience that they both went through. But at the same time, Skull and Bones does not dictate a particular political leaning. And between you and me, Skull and Bones, as powerful as it is not going to sort of tone down an election between two candidates.
Oh, no. I mean, first of all, they don't care. I think they're hedging their bets. They've already won the election.
That's right. That's right. I asked members of Skull and Bones about this. They're, on one hand, they're proud that they have the first Bones versus Bones election. On the other hand, some of them are a little embarrassed at the increased scrutiny that the election provides. But the prevailing sentiment is, you know what, this is a win-win situation, because no matter what, we have somebody in the White House for the next 4 years.
It's a sort of like betting on every horse in a horse race. You just don't know what the odds are going to be.
Right.
You know you've already won the race.
Right.
And in some cases, you hope the worst horse comes in. You never know. This organization called Skull and Bones, there's another organization, there's another group, another place called the Bohemian Grove that one of our frequent guests, Alex Jones, somehow snuck into. A lot of the same people, Alex, are in this. They go visit. They do whatever they do. And it seems, in both cases, to surround itself around bizarre rituals. What goes on with the Skull and Bones in terms of that, bizarre rituals?
Oh, they do have some strange ones. I guess I'll start with the sexual history, because that's one of the most interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one thing I found when I did the research on Skull and Bones is that in a lot of cases, the rumors and the conspiracy theories are actually based on a kernel of truth. You can't necessarily dismiss a conspiracy theory outright, because
right.
there's probably some part of it that has something to do with the truth. In this case, I hope this is okay to say on the radio, one of the most prevalent and scandalous rumors about Skull and Bones is that during initiation, the neophytes must lie naked in a coffin and masturbate while recounting their entire sexual history in front of the rest of the society. Have I been bleeped yet?
No, you haven't been bleeped.
Okay, good. That was it.
If that's as bad as you get, that's okay.
That's as bad as I get.
All right.
That rumor was so prevalent that some foreign reporters took it seriously. In truth, there's no nudity in the regular Skull and Bones program. There's no self-gratification involved in the regular Skull and Bones program. But there is a sexual history. So what happens is, after the Yale students who have been tapped for Skull and Bones come back to Yale for their senior year, they start right up in September with this sexual history. It's an activity known within Skull and Bones as connubial bliss.
All right, stay with us on that, Alex. We'll be back with you in just a moment as we talk about Skull and Bones and some of the things they do in that secret society.
access the audio archives of Coast to Coast AM. Log on to coasttocoastam.com. Somewhere out there, this is Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie.
And with our special guest tonight, Alexandra Robbins, we're talking about her book, Secrets of the Tomb. Hey, by the way, if you'd like to get the After Dark newsletter and get that free CD, Art Bell's classic interview about Mel's Hole, call 1-888-727-5505, or you can also go online at coasttocoastam.com. Alexandra Robbins, our guest right here on Coast to Coast AM. Alex, is Skull and Bones endorsed by Yale University in that, of course, it's on the grounds of Yale, but does the university have any say-so here?
You know, a lot of people ask me why Yale as a school doesn't shut down a society like this. I would say the answer is probably that it is so entrenched as a part of Yale history that administrators historically have been members of the Yale Secret Society. From Skull and Bones to Scroll and Key to Wolf's Head, I mean, there are a whole host of prestigious Yale societies, and you'll find that many of the faculty members and administrators are themselves members. So, no, they're not going to shut it down.
Well, could it be a cult? Could it be a satanic cult? Do they worship very strange idols, for example?
I would be hesitant to call them a satanic cult.
All right.
But I'll give you the reasons that some people believe they are a cult. In the initiation ceremony, for example, one of the costumes that the older members of the society dress up in is a devil costume. There are two name. Let's see. I'm trying to survey this as quickly as I can. There are two names that are handed down from class to class that have to do with the devil. One is Little Devil. One is Long Devil. John Kerry, in fact, would have been named Long Devil, but Long Devil is given to the man in the club who is the tallest person, and he missed it by about an inch. So it went to a future doctor instead. In terms of worshiping, there is a goddess that the society pays homage to. Her name is Eulogia. They call her the goddess of eloquence, and according to Skull and Bones' legend, and this is why you'll see 322 is Skull and Bones' magic number. According to Bones' legend, when the Greek orator Demosthenes died in 322 B.C., Eulogia, the goddess of eloquence, arose to the heavens. Bones' documents calls this, and I'm quoting here, the first miracle of the origin of our goddess. And then Eulogia didn't descend again until she just happened to take up residence with Skull and Bones in 1832. Or in typical affected Bones prose, they say, the equally miraculous transmigration of her spirit to Yale College. So Skull and Bones adopted the number 322 as a symbol, and now much of its biweekly program is performed in deference to this goddess. Members of Skull and Bones within the tomb are called Knights of Eulogia. They open a shrine to her at meetings, and they regularly sing sacred anthems about her, including one, and I'll give you a sample. I'm not going to sing it, but I'll give you the lyrics.
Oh, come on. Go ahead.
You know what? Here are the lyrics. Yale boasts one pride in senior year, one jewel in her crown, and only those who enter here enjoy its blessed renown. Then let us to our goddess true shout forth in loudest tones, hurrah for old 322, hurrah for Skull and Bones. It's a very sort of 19th century anthem, I guess.
When they are performing their rituals, and, you know, we've talked about some of the very bizarre behavior of some of them. I'm always thinking of that movie, Eyes Wide Shut, that Stanley Kubrick was putting together.
Got to tell you, Bonesmen don't look like Tom Cruise and Nicole Kidman trying to get images in their head.
No, they don't at all. The members of Skull and Bones, and you know, after they get out of college, are they guaranteed position in wealth?
No.
They are not?
No, they're not guaranteed anything, and there is no money that's granted to them immediately upon graduation. I think there was that movie a few years ago called The Skulls, which was based on Skull and Bones, that a lot of people took as truth. What that movie did was fictionalize everything that people truly believe about the society, but very little about that movie had a basis in truth.
That was, I think if I remember, the kids jumped off the building into a lake or something like that.
Yeah, they were trying to steal a mascot. There was one thing in that movie, for people who saw it, and I think a lot of people did, more than are willing to admit, there was one scene in that movie that did ring true. Soon after the boys are initiated, they're sort of whisked away to this beautiful island, and they're in a mansion. They're given suits, and they are introduced almost immediately to some of the very prestigious members of the society. Now, Skull and Bones does have an island. It's kind of run down. It doesn't look like the island in the movie. It's called Deer Island. It's about 350 miles from New York City in the St. Lawrence River, and that is a place where people will meet, someone from the admissions committee at Harvard, or a senator, just like in the movie.
Generally, though, if, let's say, a company president is going to hire someone, and he has got a choice between someone who was a Skull and Bones member or just somebody else, I bet he would be more apt to pick the Skull and Bones member.
Oh, without a doubt. And there are two reasons. One is, you know what, it's American business as usual to pick a crony over somebody else, whether you are a member of Skull and Bones or a fellow alum of the University of Oklahoma or something like that. But Skull and Bones really takes that mission to heart. You're pretty much expected to help if a member asks you for help. It used to be that they had a code phrase. A Skull and Bonesman would call another, stranger or a friend, and say, "Do you know General Russell?" And that means, "I'm a Bonesman, you're a Bonesman, let's work something out." However, I printed that in my book, so I hope for their sakes they changed the code.
Do the Bonesmen, while they're still in college, get the funding from anybody just to help them along?
Well, Skull and Bones has an endowment of about, I think it's around $4 million these days, $3 million. And that's basically alumni contributions. They solicit funds from alumni every year. Alumni are expected to contribute something at some point, pretty much like any alumni organization, I guess.
I'll be darned, by the way, I just heard a few more clicks on your phone. Did you hear that?
You know what? I didn't do that. That never happens on this phone. I don't even live at the same place I did before, but I'm older and wiser, so this time I do my interviews with a hockey stick.
Unbelievable. I mean, this happened last time.
Yeah, but you're not going to freak me out this time.
No, I don't intend to, but if I hear a few more clicks, I'm going to start getting suspicious.
All right.
That's something. Is there a link between the Skull and Bones and other organizations in government, groups, the CFR, Council on Foreign Relations, anything like that?
Well, Skull and Bones, I should say, does not operate in concert with any other organization. Skull and Bones does not, for instance, work together with Bohemian Grove or the Trilateral Commission or something else. You will, however, see member overlap. You will see things like Skull and Bones has some room designs that are sort of very Masonic. But in terms of how it operates with other organizations, I think the closest you can come is the CIA.
Oh, really? There is a link there, though.
There is definitely a strong link between Bones and the CIA. Several of the hordes of Bonesmen who became CIA operatives, especially in the late 20th century, came back to the tomb and actually discussed issues that some Bonesmen told me they thought they shouldn't have, as National Security Advisor McGeorge Bundy reportedly did in the 1960s.
Mm-hmm.
As one Bonesman said to me, he said, "The things that fascinated me at PAT gatherings," PAT is short for Patriarch, which is their alumni, were the level of penetration. There were an awful lot of Bones in the CIA and how open they were about talking in the tomb. He said to me they talked about foreign operations at the time, and they talked about things like what later became the Iran-Contra affair. So there is a very strong link, and what's even more interesting is that during the 1960s, when Bush and Kerry were in Skull and Bones, the CIA was known to them as the employer of last resort, which meant that if Bonesmen couldn't get a job anywhere else, the CIA would take them.
Would take them and put them in some capacity.
Right.
Huh. Well, you know, I was watching the presidential debates, and they were talking about Yale University, and they both looked at each other with this very sly look. They did not mention Skull and Bones, never came up, but when they talked about Yale, they had a very strange look at each other. And I found that to be weird, Alexandra.
Yeah, it is a little weird. I've heard more about what Kerry thinks about this whole thing than what Bush thinks. Kerry thinks it's amusing that they're both members of Skull and Bones. For him, it's nothing more than that.
Mm-hmm.
For Bush, I think it's more of a problem because his family is so entrenched in Skull and Bones, and they've really used its connections.
I mean, what are the odds, though, of two Skull and Bones members running for the highest office in the land?
It's got to be pretty low, but you know, it's also fair to say that Yale is a place and Skull and Bones is a place that promotes public service. In order to be successful, there is a mentality at Yale that you have to run for office.
Does it shape an individual? I mean, does a young by the way, does it admit women?
Does Skull and Bones?
Yeah.
Yeah, and I can give you the short version or the long version of that story, depending on how close we are to break.
Well, we got a long time.
All righty. Well, the Bones Club of 1971 was the first club to pretty much formally propose admitting women. Bones has ever since called the Bones Club of 1971 the Bad Club. The Club of 71 elected three women who were prepared to be what the Bonesmen called the Jackie Robinsons of Skull and Bones. But the patriarchs, or alumni, were just outraged when they heard about this. They demanded a meeting, which they held in a private room at an expensive French restaurant in New York. And at the restaurant, the 15 seniors were ushered into assigned seats that split them up along the 50 alumni. And the seniors were pretty shocked to see around them some of the society's more prominent members. There were people like Jonathan Bush, which is W's uncle, McGeorge Bundy, Tex McCreary. After cocktails and dinner, a senior who's now an actor in Hollywood delivered an eloquent speech about why the group of 1971 wanted to elect women. Sometime during that speech, McGeorge Bundy elbowed the alumni next to him and said really loudly, "Oh, so Aunt Jemima's coming to dinner now." And, you know, the room laughed. Yeah, it was ridiculous. When the actor ended his speech by saying that nothing goes on in the tomb that women can't be a part of, Jonathan Bush apparently shot up out of his chair and retorted that you guys used the place wrong. So, you know, these seniors in 71 were wondering, as one of them told me, well, what in the heck did they do in there?
Yeah, yeah.
Finally, the patriarchs issued an ultimatum. They said if the 1971 group taps women, the alumni seals the tomb for a year. And the alternative was for members of the Bad Club, as they called it, to stay in the restaurant and tap women. Half the knights walked out. The remaining seven elected the men of the 1972 club. So fast forward 20 years. In 1991, the Bones seniors again intended to tap women. Patriarchs heard about this, changed the locks of the tomb, threatened to shut down the society. When the seniors threatened a lawsuit this time, Skull and Bones decided to hold a vote. In that vote, Bones narrowly endorsed admitting women. So women were all set to join. But the day before initiation, a group of bonesmen led by William F. Buckley obtained a court order blocking initiation, claiming that admitting women, and I'm going to quote them verbatim here, admitting women would lead to date rape in the medium-term future.
God.
Eventually, Bones held another vote that again narrowly admitted women. But once the women were initiated, and there are now women in Bones, several of the older members, including a former congressman who spoke with me, distanced themselves from the society.
I wonder if the judge who issued the order was also a Bonesman.
I looked that up. He was not, but hey, maybe he had a Bones relative.
You never know. You never know. Or he owed somebody a favor.
Exactly.
How has this influenced, if at all, our current president?
Yeah, Bones has influenced George W. Bush, it seems. He seems to have relied on Bones in many stages throughout his professional life for money, for connections. And since he became president, Bush has followed Bones' agenda, which is to get members into positions of power. I mean, there's a long list of members. I'll just go through a few because
right.
I don't want to bore people. But one of his early appointments was Robert McCallum. He's now Associate U.S. Attorney General. And point about McCallum, in 2002, McCallum filed pleadings in U.S. District Court seeking to make information on presidential pardons more secret than in the past. So here's another Bonesman sort of contributing to secrecy in the government today. Surprise, surprise. Who else? There is Bill Donaldson, Chairman of the Securities and Exchange Commission. He was actually once the director of the Deer Island Corporation, which runs that private island. Anyway, Bush tapped him for that. There's Edward McNally, the general counsel of the Office of Homeland Security. There's Evan Galbraith, the Secretary of Defense's representative in Europe, and on and on. And then it turns out that Frederick Smith, the founder of FedEx and a Bonesman, was reportedly Bush's top choice for Secretary of Defense, but Smith had to withdraw from consideration for health reasons. So Bush is pretty involved with Skull and Bones, as much as he likes to try to distance himself vocally from Yale, from Northeastern elite connections, from anything that's not, you know, down home Texas.
Would you consider it to be a very powerful organization, society?
Yes. Yes, in terms of its alumni network.
Yeah, the network is its strength, isn't it?
Yes.
Now, when you said it's got an endowment of $4 million, nowadays that doesn't seem like a lot of money.
No, that surprises a lot of people. People think that Skull and Bones is inordinately wealthy, and it's not. Skull and Bones only gets money from donations. That money that goes directly to the institution mainly goes to upkeep of the tomb, paying the cooks, stuff like that. However, In Bones, basically, the money happens after graduation when members will directly pay other members if asked, whether they're investing in companies or something like that.
And there's a lot of money behind them in terms of their families?
In many cases, yeah.
Now, when you said that they admit 15 a year, right?
Right.
That doesn't seem like a lot of people.
No, it's not. That's why it's so weird that two of them are running against each other for the presidency. Because
right.
If you count it out, basically it amounts to about 800 living members at any one time. So 2 out of 800 is a pretty high proportion.
Any idea what their real agenda is? I mean, are they supporters of a one-world government or anything like that?
No, and I know a lot of your listeners think that, but there is no political agenda in Skull and Bones. It's really just, let's get members into positions of power, get as wealthy and prestigious a roster of alumni as possible.
I was going to say there's a financial agenda here, right?
Sure, they want to get as much money as possible, yeah.
When you started working on this, you then started investigating sororities. Tell me about the tie-in, if any. Are you there? The phone finally got her, so we're going to redial her and find out where she is. Let's see if she's on the top bank by any chance, Dan, if she's there. Alexandra, are you there?
Can you hear me now?
Yeah, I sure can.
Okay, excellent.
Wonder how that happened.
My phone just ran out of batteries.
Oh, was it your phone?
Yeah, it was my phone.
Yeah, well, in that case, I'm going to bring you down to a different bank here. Let's see if you're still here. Hold on, okay? Are you there?
Still here.
Okay, all right. It was you, not us.
Yeah, it was me. My bad.
Okay, so you're all set?
I'm all set.
Okay, good. So my question was, before we were attacked by someone. The fact that these organizations are out there, and that the members really look toward their membership in order to do what they're going to do, is that a good thing or a bad thing for America?
No, I think it's a horrible thing. I don't think our country should be represented by people who represent the same old slice of American life over and over again. I don't think there should be this group of people who automatically think they're superior to the rest of us just because they belong to this elite club. And I don't like the fact that our presidential candidates aren't opening up about their allegiance to a secret society, because that means they automatically prioritize this secret society above the interests of the country. Secrecy is bad in government, I think, because secrecy overshadows democracy. You need a certain amount of transparency in government in order to be able to hold elected officials accountable for their actions. And if they prioritize secrecy, then that's not going to happen. In a word.
In a word. Now, after you wrote the book, did you have any problems? Did anybody try to do something? You know, you talked a little bit about the magazine article you wrote, but what about the book?
Yeah, I really didn't get much of a reaction from Bones. I heard through the grapevine that people were pretty angry, but nothing happened like the career thread I got.
Now, you also investigated sororities.
Yes.
Tell me a little bit about that.
Oh, goodness. Sororities are pretty much just as interesting as Skull and Bones, I think. And I think one thing your listeners might be interested to know is that in many cases, some sororities are really as campy as the stereotypes. I mean, that image of the topless pillow fights that you hear about in sororities,
mm-hmm.
is not that far-fetched. In one sorority, for example, sisters heckled pledges while forcing them to watch porn videos without smiling. They also had a tradition called boob ranking. During boob ranking, pledges had a limited amount of time to strip off their shirts and bras and examine each other topless so that by the time the clock was up, they would be lined up in order of chest size for the sisters to inspect. Some sororities hold naked parties, and I hear the music, so we'll have to hold off on those naked parties.
We'll come back in a moment with our guest Alexandra Robbins right here on Coast to Coast AM.
Want to time travel? Go back to past shows on Streamlink. Sign up online at coasttocoastam.com.